Well, good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. You are probably as weary of us thanking you so often since the end of the pledge drive as when we were soliciting your pledges last week. So, thanks. Thanks very much. As we keep exhorting, it is your station. You just let us know how much you like your shares in this little organization. Public radio beats all other forms of radio and most media. Well, good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I'd like to read a few things, and so I better read quickly because I have quite a few things to read. I'd like to start with the A&E Sunday from the Oregonian this past Sunday. If you were to have seen it, you would see a photograph of the original group called Timberbound. And that's what I'd like to read about. It features Hobe Kider, among other things. I'm sure many of you folks know Hobe, and that's why I decided to read it. It's called Oregon Folk Revival. And it's written by Jason Sims. In the 1970s, the original Timberbound, with Kimberly Kunick on fiddle and guitar, Hobe Kider on banjo and guitar, Dave Berg on auto harp and guitar, Mark Loring on mandolin, and everyone singing, performed and wrote upbeat sing-along folk songs that never found their way on an album, but made a lasting mark among folk circles in Oregon. Today, those songs are being revived for a new generation. Joe Siemens, who grew up hearing his parents and their friends sing the tunes, joined forces with like-minded musicians for a new incarnation of Timberbound. One of Joe Siemens' earliest memories is listening to people sing in harmony in a cabin heated by a wood stove. As he grew up in Deer Island near the town of Rainier, he realized some of the folk songs his parents liked to sing were standards and others were written by their friends who called themselves Timberbound. Siemens, who is 29, has formed a new band under the name and recorded an album of their music to be released this weekend. Siemens recalls that throughout his youth, the Timberbound songs would just blur together with I'll Fly Away and those songs that everybody knows. That's a quote from Siemens. Yet they told the story of where he was from and people his family knew. Kimberly Ruby Fergus, then known as Kim Kunick, lived with her first husband, John Kunick, at an old logging camp called Kesey near Vernonia from 1973 to 1976. John worked part-time at a sawmill and Kimberly worked at a food store. They ate berries and mushrooms and bathed in a stream. They played music together for fun, and John brought out his banjo at any social opportunity. When John died in a car accident, Kimberly turned to music and her neighbors. I got through my worst grief that way, she says. I had a project. The original Timberbound performed the Kunick's music and wrote others upbeat sing-along folk songs. They sang about logging and fishing, filling their lyrics with the names of tools like skidder, yarder, and green chain. They humbly glorified the Northwest with refrains like, here's to the boys of Columbia County, ain't got the sense to come out of the rain. Siemens became fascinated with these songs when he started studying music at Lewis and Clark College in 2003. He realized that this group from the 1970s was playing a style that went further back to a time when folk music was more informal and folkloric and less focused on singer-songwriters. This is a type of music that not a lot of people are trying to make anymore, he says. After college, Siemens toured the country for several years with his Renegade String Band, and he recently co-founded Rhapsody, a workshop on blues and folk, which has conducted programs in Oregon schools and as far away as Kentucky. Yet recording Timberbound's music was always in the back of his mind, he says. While they made little money performing, Fergus says, they played to some very receptive audiences who sometimes wept when they heard John's story and his music. A couple of these performances survive on tape, and Kimberly published a very limited Timberbound songbook. But within a couple of years, she met her current husband and moved to British Columbia and ultimately Costa Rica. The group's material was never recorded in a studio until now. Timberbound's self-titled debut features Siemens on banjo and vocals, Gavin Duffy on guitar, dobro, and vocals, Kate Sandgren singing, and Jenny Estrin playing fiddle. I think it's great that it's going around again, says Fergus, who is actually not all that surprised by Siemens' project. It looked like it was going that direction, she says of the music. She visited Oregon about 15 years ago and found that people she knew, and even some she didn't, had been singing these songs all that time, and they were part of their life. Siemens says concert goers who remember the glory days of Oregon logging and fishing often thank him for keeping this music alive. He sees it as a two-way transaction. Maybe I'm giving something to the song by recording it in a studio, he says. But at the same time, the song gives me an identity and helps me understand where I'm from. That's more valuable than anything I can do for the songs. And that was Timberbound Gives Voice to Fading Oregon Folk Songs by Jason Sims for the Oregonian. This past Sunday in its A&E Sunday section. And now I'd like to read something by Michael Schroff. I was unaware that Michael had died last month until I ran into his brother last Sunday and he told me. And Michael's one of the oldest friends I have in Oregon. And he's also a pioneer of KMUN. As Doug Sweet, longtime general manager for KMUN, remembers in The Current, which I hadn't picked up by then, Michael was indeed a good energy in the early days and with some experience to boot. He worked on many radio stations like KBOO. He did all kinds of writing for different newspapers. And he, again, was part of the team that got KMU on the air. As Doug Sweet says, I was doing carpentry leading up to the debut, and Michael was able to indicate where things should go. Turntables here, microphone there, guest mic over there. He was a good on-air personality, and we will all miss him for the new gap in our history and communal fabric. And what I'd like to do is read a story that Michael wrote for my newspaper, the North Coast Times-Eagle, in its first issue, Friday, July 20th, 1979. And so this was written way back then, so I'm going to just leave it as he wrote it without updating it any. And you'll see how much it seems like it's today. Timber's catch 22, cutting more because there's less. The president and the governors of Oregon and Washington want to increase the rate of logging in the Pacific Northwest. They say it would mean more government revenue from timber sales and ease inflation. It would also help support the timber industry, which is running out of trees. Carter says his plan is temporary, as President Carter, Jimmy Carter, to offset inflation, help reverse the declining rate of housing starts, and generally boost the nation's economy. It's similar in a way to deregulating the oil industry. The difference is trees are renewable while oil is not. But are the forests being renewed? Trees in Oregon and Washington are being cut down faster than they are being grown. We can't simply ignore the situation that's emerging in the Pacific Northwest, said Max Peterson, the new chief of the U.S. Forest Service. in 1979. He told Washington correspondent Steve Forrester, that's when Forrester was in D.C., in the Daily Astorian, "We know that we're faced with substantial reductions in our output from the private lands. We can't ignore the fact that much of the softwood timber in the Pacific Northwest is on national forest land, and we're going to have to look very carefully at the president's new direction to depart from sustained yield policies." Peterson said he thinks it's a crisis. That's going to be a problem for at least 10 to 15 years. Senator Robert Packwood, remember him, said recently that he is concerned that Carter's timber policy will cause a more serious downturn in the forest economy of the Northwest in the mid-1980s than is now forecast. Packwood said that Carter's call for a temporary increase will shorten the time it will take to run out of trees large enough to harvest commercially. The Oregonian, editorializing against increased federal cutting, noted there is no provision for funds for reforestation. Timber companies and environmentalists agree it will take more money than is now available to replant the federal forests at an even flow rate with cutting. Three studies were completed which said trees on privately owned industrial timberland in Oregon were being harvested statewide five times faster than they were being reforested and removed three times faster than reforestation on federal lands. One of the studies was done by Dr. John Buter, who was named head of the Oregon State University Department of Forest Management shortly after his recession predicting survey was completed. Buter explains, "There's been rather heavy cutting on private land since World War II to meet the demands of housing and this sort of thing. Our study showed that in most of the timber sheds in western Oregon, there is very likely to be a decline in harvest from industry lands. It's an inventory problem, so there'll be a gap between the time the current stock of merchantable trees begins to get depleted and the younger trees become merchantable. In such areas, we're probably in the midst of it already." Buter agrees that the gap and its resultant harvest slowdown could last 10 to 15 years and could mean as much as 20 to 30% unemployment, not only in the timber industry itself, but throughout Oregon, and would influence the nation as wood supplies decrease. "The forests of America will not be able to meet the demands of the paper industry by 1990, according to several industry trade magazines," quoted by Scott Traxler, a business forecaster of the Center for Economic Education of the University of Central Florida. "Timber supply is becoming so short," Traxler says, "that the industry is considering using tropical hardwoods as a pulp base. Already, several weather experts say that much of the world's tropical rainforests have been cut down, that weather patterns have changed noticeably." Buter testified at Oregon Department of Energy hearings about future forest industry needs. He was asked by the DOE, "It has been argued that reduction of raw log export and increases in processing in the region and new technology and products would probably more than offset the time impact of declining harvest. Please give us your professional opinion." Buter replied, "We based our assumption of productivity increases on the extrapolation of past trends. It seems reasonable that the wood products industries will continue to seek ways of becoming more efficient, i.e. increased productivity. Whether new technology and products, lower log exports, and increased processing in the region occur and create more employment remains to be seen. I would venture to guess that new technology will likely be less labor-intensive than current technology, thus requiring even less workers per unit of harvest than current technology. Log exports play a big part in the rapid decline of our forests. Japan now pays 2 to 3 times more money for good Douglas fir and hemlock as mills in the United States are paying. Crown Zellerbach reached its export quota in early November 2 years ago. They had a very large coal deck on road siding and offered a sale to 43 Columbia region mills, according to a Portland Crown public relations man. He said Crown received only one reply saying, "Your price is too high." Over the years, this and other marketing practices have had the effect of causing many small independent mills to close, consolidating the nationals and internationals as they capture the market. When the smaller mills move into financial difficulty, the bigger companies buy them out, gaining more timber holdings and mills, which are sometimes scrapped for spare parts after the trees are removed by the new owners, as Georgia Pacific did with the Booth Kelly holdings in Lane County, according to Congressman Jim Weaver of Eugene. Japan stopped cutting its forests when it realized their watersheds would be destroyed if they continued to harvest. They found a ready market in the Northwest United States and in British Columbia. Weyerhaeuser and others encouraged this, using money from the new sales to expand their holdings and mill capacity, which led to cutting many more trees to meet the new demand. The domestic demand was growing rapidly at the same time. About 60% of Oregon's hemlock and most prime Douglas fir now go to Japan. And that was by Michael Schroff. Timbers Catch 22, Cutting More Because There's Less. And he wrote it for the first issue of the North Coast Times Eagle, Volume 1, Number 1, the revived North Coast Times Eagle, on Friday, 20 July, 1979. And I just happened to remember that he had written that, and I thought I'd like to put that one out. It was the first issue I turned out, the first of many. I put it out for almost 30 years. And now I'd like to read something that Bruce Buckmaster wrote to present to a little gathering, Finding a Way to Win, which was held by many locals talking about problems and stuff given in the local areas on March 8th. And the incomplete plan for honoring our heritage, preserving our jobs, protecting salmon, and bridging the urban-rural divide. And Bruce quotes Robert Burns, "It's not fish you're buying, it's men's lives." The history of Columbia River commercial fishermen is a fascinating and rich story of the oldest continuing industry west of the Rockies, and it is absolutely irrelevant to the people who want us off the river. Salmon for All, the organization that represents our commercial fishermen, fish processors, and allied businesses, values our history, but actually exists to protect and promote a modern industry. An industry that is committed to providing an ever-expanding market, the finest salmon and sturgeon on the planet. We're an industry devoted to sustainable harvest, resource protection, innovation, and enough profit to provide living wage, jobs, and reinvestment. In Oregon and Washington, we have about 400 active fishing businesses and a dozen or so buyers and processors. Over two-thirds of licensed Columbia River commercial fisher people live in four lower Columbia River counties: Clatsop in Oregon, Wakayakum, Pacific, and Grays Harbor in Washington. These counties rank in the lowest per capita income field according to the U.S. Census of 2000. Our family fishermen and women were instrumental in creating the first Oregon Fish Commission. Our processors demanded and achieved fish passage at Bonneville Dam. Our fisher people developed and adopted new net technology and recovery boxes in order to release endangered fish unharmed. These small businessmen and women helped create and continue to financially support safe area fisheries in the Young's Bay and Tongue Point, not as a replacement to the main stem Columbia, but as a supplement to it. Our fisher people have forged strong and lasting relationships with tribal fishers. Salmon for All routinely meets and consults with the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. Breaking long-standing practice, the tribes have weighed in on matters affecting our fishery in support of our community. Through immense effort, our commercial salmon fishing families have defeated five ballot measures that were designed to end their industry and eliminate their jobs, three in Oregon and two in Washington. The latest measure, Oregon 81, was defeated in 2012 with a statewide no vote of 65.3%. In Clatsop County, Measure 81 garnered 308 yes votes and 15,050 no's, a resounding defeat of 87%. The cost to our fishermen and their friends was almost $1 million. This is money that was not spent in our community, but can only be chalked up as the price of battling greed. In 2009 and 2011, Salmon for All successfully defeated two attempts to legislate a so-called Safe for Salmon plan in Oregon. This plan would have relegated our fishery to small off-channel areas and was virtually assured of killing our industry. Salmon for All is constantly monitoring over 25 governmental entities or acts that can affect our fishery. If you add interaction with the many non-governmental groups that either want our health or all too often our demise, it is a wonder we find time to fish at all. From such a limited group of members, Salmon for All has achieved a great deal. We are fortunate to have a wealth of talented and committed activists. Reverend Irene Martin, the rector of St. James Episcopal in Cathlamet, is a wonderful speaker, historian, and author. She has even proved willing to wear her clerical collar when testifying before legislative committees and fish commissions. Hobe Kiter, you remember I just read about him. The Salmon for All administrator is an author, archivist, and possesses an impressive talent for reading all the fine print. Jim Wells, our longtime president, couples 40 years of operating a family fishing business with presentation skills steeped in gravitas. Carrie Johnson, a fourth-generation Astoria fisherman, is at home in Salem, effectively lobbying any legislator willing to listen. We have Robert Sudar from Longview. Robert is a fish buyer and engineer. His technical presentations on our behalf are always unimpeachable. Steve Fick, owner of Fishhawk Fisheries, never misses a meeting and has logged many thousands of miles in representing the interests of our industry. Countless other fishermen contribute their wisdom, time, and money advocating for the public's access to Columbia River salmon. It is clear to me that the true legacy of Columbia River fishing is not merely beautiful old boats and evocative sepia-tone photographs. It is the people, hardworking, tolerant, intelligent, and giving, whether first or sixth generation. They collectively comprise a priceless asset, and they embody everything we should value in our community. If I stopped here, I would probably leave you with the idea that our industry has amassed a long list of victories. We have, but we are also slowly losing the war. Make no mistake, we are engaged in a war of attrition where we are continually outspent. More importantly, we are clearly outnumbered. The number of active commercial fishermen has declined by 2/3 in the last 70 years. There are many more sport fishermen than commercial. Hell, there are more sports than the entire population of the four lower river counties. They are legion, and they are ravenous. Currently, about 3% of Oregonians have sport salmon fishing licenses. This small percentage, along with their Washington counterparts, are harvesting 80% of Columbia River spring salmon, 80% of the sturgeon, and all the summer and fall chinook and coho that seven-day-a-week fishing can provide. Oddly, their appetite for harvest is not matched by their contribution to fish production. Less than 7% of the operation cost of Columbia River hatcheries derives from sports fishing dollars. The general public pays the rest, and the non-fishing public has only one way to enjoy the bounty they are paying for. We are the public's fisher people. I began my work on behalf of our fisher people 20 years ago. Back then, we fought to gain more access to fish. It was in this era that our local select areas were begun as a way to keep us fishing while endangered or threatened runs of salmon were rebuilt. Through the years, as sport fishing interests demanded an ever-expanding share of fish harvest from state fish and wildlife commissions, we were increasingly fighting to hold on to what we had. Times change, but greed does not. In the last 5 years, we find that we are now fighting to survive as a viable industry. The Safe for Salmon bill we defeated in 2009 and 2011 has come back as the Kitzhaber plan. The governor certainly did not write the plan, but he bought in hook, line, and sinker. He was convinced that he could make radical and untested sweeping changes to our fishery, and by the use of unrealistic economic forecasts, we would somehow be unharmed. Frankly, the governor was willingly bamboozled, and our community was royally screwed. The governor and his staff put constant pressure on the six-person Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission to approve the plan. You may ask, aren't we supposed to have a seven-person commission? Indeed we are, but the seat from our congressional district has remained empty since the end of Commissioner John England's term. The seat has been empty for almost 2 years. Our region was not represented throughout the infamous plan's approval process. Prior to voting on the governor's plan, Oregon and Washington commissions convened a work group to evaluate the new regime. We were well represented on the work group, but clearly the deck was stacked against any changes we proposed. At the first meeting, one of the five Kitzhaber appointees stated that he worked for the governor, quote unquote, and consequently had to vote as directed by his boss. We pointed out that, in fact, while appointed by the governor, commissions worked for all Oregonians. He disagreed. The plan emerged unchanged from the work group, with all four representatives from our industry objecting. Both state commissions approved the plan despite hours of truthful, logical, and sometimes heartbreaking testimony from our fishermen and women. Enabling legislation passed the Oregon legislature in 2013 under constant shepherding by the governor's staff. We were able to insert one small item in the final bill. The commission was directed to create a small sports exclusion zone immediately in front of Young's Bay. We asked that the salmon returning to our largest remaining fishing area not to be intercepted by a large fleet of sports parked at the entrance to the bay. The groups that wrote the Kitzhaber plan got everything they asked for, are currently screaming foul due to the tiny exclusion zone. In a nutshell, here's the plan. It establishes sport priority for all main stem Columbia River fisheries. It mandates an unproven and very expensive commercial seine fishery for mopping up after sports catch their fill. It promises to produce more fish returning to select areas for commercial harvest. It does not save a single endangered or threatened native salmon. It is inadequately funded in the short term and non-funded in the long term. It totally ignores the precautionary principle by placing all of the risk on our fishermen and none on the people proposing the plan. If everything goes right, a few commercial fisher people may be here in 10 years. I could go on, but I'll fly into a rage and become incoherent. Actually, when I begin to think about this talk, I wanted to figure out a way to get you angry. Then I realized that even if I was capable of such oratory, it would not provide a solution to the problems our fisher people face. I haven't been able to stay angry and fearful for 20 years. I ask myself why I stay committed. The reason is principle. I cannot hold on to an emotional experience as I do to a principle, because it is and then is not. Whereas a principle supports us in consistency just as long as we choose that it should. Feelings and instinct have a history of bouncing me around in bursts of activity. So what are the principles in play? Justice. How can we allow families that have invested their lives into hard work, advocacy, innovation be ruined for the sake of greed? Honesty. Can we allow the lies which form the bulk of attack upon our fisher people go unchallenged? Courage. In the face of overwhelming adversity, our neighbors are continuing to fight. Can we allow them to fight alone? Hope. Integrity. Willingness. Service. So what is the plan and what can you do to help? I don't know. I did say it was an incomplete plan. What I do know is Salmon for All has not been able to do the one thing that could change the whole ball game. Despite our history of winning against ballot initiatives, the vast majority of Oregonians don't know us. If we are truly honest, we would have to say that it is comparatively easy to get voters to reject an action when it is shown that it is based on greed. It is another thing entirely to enlist the affection and social ownership of an industry they know little or nothing about. Something has to happen in someone's heart before anything happens in Astoria. Columbia River commercial fisher people should be iconic and memorable. It should be a part of Oregon DNA that they are to be valued and protected. Mention of fisheries should produce a warm sense of pride in Medford, Baker, and yes, Northwest Portland. There is no urban-rural divide on this issue, just a wide gap filled to the brim with blithe indifference. At Salmon for All, we know how critical this message is, but we simply don't know how to accomplish the task. We vaguely understand and are awed by the apparent power of social media. Unfortunately, going viral to most of us means running a fever and not being able to get on the boat. Someone, somewhere knows how to change the way our industry is perceived. They already have the right idea in their head. In fact, like most people, they have all sorts of good ideas ready to go. Like Tinder, the ideas are ready to ignite. I sincerely hope that the spark will come from the knowledge of our fishing community's plight. The easiest way to make a person, a legislator, a commissioner, or even a governor do the right thing is to take all the wrong choices off the table. When the majority of Oregonians own our fishery, many wrong choices will disappear. If one of you chooses to accept this task, what could possibly be in it for you? Let's return to the principles and Albert Schweitzer in his reply to a request from a school class. You asked me to give you a motto. Here it is, service. Let this word accompany each of you throughout your life. Let it be before you as you seek your way and your duty in the world. May it be recalled to your minds if ever you are tempted to forget it or set it aside. It will not always be a comfortable companion, but it will always be a faithful one, and it will be able to lead you to happiness, no matter what the experiences of your lives are. Please help us and find happiness. And that was by Bruce Buckmaster, which he read here in Astoria on March 8th at the Finding a Way to Win. And I understand he himself might be have been recorded and be on the air here, and so he's probably will read it much better than me. And this has been Michael McCusker. This is KMUN KTCB Astoria Killamuck, 91.9 and 89.5 FM. I'm sorry I read those things so fast, but I wanted to get it all in within the half hour.